It is now my pleasure to introduce our speaker. He is named in our program. It's Dr. Gordon Bell. He came to AA about 1946, and he hasn't been able to put a year together yet, I don't think. And all I can say is thank God I hadn't thought of that one. Dr. Bell is well known in the medical field. He has spent virtually his entire medical career in the field of alcoholism. I know that in talking to people in North America, as I have in traveling, that he is respected medical authority on the field, on this field, and his name is to alcoholism is Dr. Best is to the field of diabetes, and that's saying something. He founded many, several hospitals, I should say, as a treatment center, and the present one is the Donwood Institute in Toronto, which sort of encompasses the title of this meeting, Donwood being a community health center. The title of our meeting is Community Therapy. I now call on Dr. Bell.
Thank you, Chairman Ed. First of all, I would like to tell you how honored I feel at being invited again to speak to you. I have to begin any address to an AA group with the same kind of comments. Had it not been for AA, there is no doubt at all that I would not have had any desire to continue in this work, because when it happened in 1946, as far as I'm concerned, quite unexpectedly, when it happened that I found myself in the position of trying to help people who had become disabled by an uncontrolled dependence upon alcohol, when I realized I knew absolutely nothing about what was wrong with them or what to do for them, when I could find no assistance at all amongst my peers in the medical profession, my former teachers, who suggested that I get out of this business as quickly as possible, that there was no way you could help those drunks, didn't matter how you warned them about their livers or whatever, they just got drunk anyway. My own initial naive efforts tended to confirm their opinion. My patients tended to get drunk about as often as I sobered them up. And I was quite prepared to throw in the towel and decide I'd better look at something else. Except for the fact that 11 years previously, 1935, a very significant development as far as the health professions are concerned, as well as the world is concerned, had begun in the United States. And two men whose lives had been practically destroyed by the fantastic power of a crippling dependence upon alcohol, got together and decided to work on a new formula as to how to cope with this problem. As you well know the story, I don't need to repeat this for you. All the problems they had between 1935 and 39 and they came out to the big boat. And following that, in a rather surprisingly rapid rate, groups were formed in the major population centers in North America, including Toronto. So when I found myself in this position of trying to treat patients and realizing more and more that I knew nothing at all about what was wrong with these people, I went to the AA group at 1170 Yonge Street. I don't know how many of you ever went to that group. I was rather intrigued with the location, you know, right across the road from the liquor store. But and that's where, 31 years ago, I went to my first AA meeting. Believe me, I wasn't very popular. I was a spy in camp. Certainly at that time, members of this organization were totally justified in saying only the alcoholic can help the alcoholic. And above everything, stay away from those doctors. They'll only get you hooked on pills. So I wasn't exactly welcomed 31 years ago as you welcomed me today. But I was very intrigued. It had been my responsibility in the Army to organize clinics for the Royal Canadian Army Medical Corps for people disabled emotionally. They didn't have alcohol or drug problems, but they were disabled by their states of anxiety and depression. I knew something about that. I knew something about the new developing group techniques of group therapy, which got a great impetus in the Second World War. I knew what it was to work with psychologists and so on. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I knew what it was to administer such a clinic. And therefore, I was fascinated with what I saw, because I couldn't understand it. I realized that I was witnessing a whole new dimension in therapy. It was much later that I began to think of the right label for it, community therapy. This wasn't just group therapy. I began to realize here were a group of people seriously disabled, both by the most stigmatized illness in the community. No other sick person was viewed by the clinical and other branches of the community as these people were. And he began to understand why it had become necessary for them to come together and form their own community. They had formed a supplementary community to facilitate interrelationships over and above those that were possible in their family, with their work associates, and in their region or neighborhood, because they were forced to. For one thing, there was no other setting in which it was safe to share experience. Now, why was I so fascinated with this? Long before I graduated in medicine, I happened to have been fascinated by sociology and anthropology. I happened to be fascinated with man's needs as a social being. I didn't have to be sold on that one. We are social beings. We need people as a fish needs water. And if you run into any kind of situation that tends to interrupt the opportunity of functioning as a social being, the opportunity for meaningful interaction with other people, then you'll find an abnormal situation for a person. You can take a perfectly normal person, showing no undue indication of stress at all, whether they're a child, teenager, adult, or an old person. And if that person is satisfactorily integrated into a group of other people, adapting satisfactorily and in a meaningful, productive way, it's unlikely that there'll be a great deal of anxiety, depression, frustration, or whatever. But all you have to do is pull them out of the social setting, and immediately there are a whole range of symptoms will be evident and probably sufficient to justify a lot of the labels that our psychiatric confreres use.
just remove him. Well, here we had an illness. Here we had an illness that by its very nature tended to progressively desocialize a whole bunch of people. So to counteract this, they had come together, they formed their own community, and these two pioneers, 35 to 39, did the absolutely fundamental thing for any community in all of the history of time. They came together with a system of beliefs, spiritual beliefs, system of beliefs with a spiritual orientation, which has been the core substance of any sustaining community since the beginning of time. So I began to be fascinated by the fact these people formed a community. Now, what do they do in it? What do they do when they're really in trouble now? They turn to one another instead of to the bottle. They have found an alternative. They have shifted. They're using this fabric of this community to shift from a dependence upon chemicals to a dependence upon people. This fascinated me. And finally, the thing that most impressed me was that it seemed to work. As I listened to the first speakers getting up and talking about having interrupted their use of alcohol not 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, but say 2 or 3 years ago, that, well, the universal pessimism concerning the treatability of dependence seems to be challenged by what I hear here. Who's right? My peers, the professors, the social scientists, or these people getting to their feet? These people, as far as I'm concerned, seem to be able to relate an experience in which, first of all, they interrupted the dependence. They seem to have gone through a period in which this dependence progressively declined. They talk about really concentrating on it initially, turning to one another, going to meetings one day at a time. They're consciously aware of a significant aspect of their life that isn't there anymore. Then they talk about an inactivation of dependence. They don't talk about killing it. They say one drink away from a drunk. They aren't saying that it's gone, but it seems that they have identified a method, and they use a 12-step program. And it is possible, with a community model, to shift from a dependence upon chemicals to a new dependence on one's own unused resources, a new dependence upon other people, and a new dependence upon a power that transcends people altogether. This is, in quickly, a summary of the beliefs that I had 31 years ago. And why bother going ahead with the clinic? Maybe these people have got the answer. Remember, I had been operating clinics for emotionally disturbed people. But another thing that fascinated me, I saw some of the most tense people I ever knew in my life who had still managed to interrupt their dependence upon alcohol and inactivate it. And the prevalent idea that you first have to deal with a person's psychological or psychiatric problems before they can do it seemed to me to be wrong. These people have interrupted and inactivated at controlling serious dependence upon alcohol in spite of the fact they weren't even reasonably comfortable. Then I thought, up to now, the human resources available to these people are found amongst their peers. Let's see, we hold on to everything that this organization can provide. Let's hold on to this concept. Let's hold on to this philosophy of a shift in dependence, as I've tried to outline. But then why can't we open up the rest of the community to them? And if there should be any benefit in having access to the clinical resources in a community for any reason, or any related physical disabilities, any related psychological or emotional disabilities, let's get them into this community. Furthermore, let's extend it to the non-professional segment of the community, the employers, the families, all of the other people, and let us do what we can to interrupt and to deflate and to destroy the stigma related to this most serious area of disturbed health. These are the things that initially motivated me. Now, I'd like to tell you one or two interesting little sidelights before I go on, because I'd like to tell you how now, after 31 years, how clinically we are trying to look at this whole situation, certainly at Donwood, and finally end up telling you where I think that this community therapy model can, the future of it, and the areas where it conceivably could be applied over and above the problems associated with the controlling dependence upon alcohol or drugs. But I want to tell you about one AA group I visited. And this was in Joyceville Penitentiary at Kingston. Now, I was very thrilled to get the invitation from these people to go down and speak to them. And they, you know, with the, to me, this rather offbeat humor of the ex-drinkers, they called their group the Liberty Group. Now, to show their appreciation for my visit, they'd undertaken to hammer out the AA prayer on a copper plaque. Now, I don't know whether they didn't have quite time to finish it or not, because when it came to the R in group, they didn't quite finish it. So the bar was off, so it was a P instead of an R. So my prayer is headed up the Liberty Gapoop. You know? But I just mentioned that as one of the many, many occasions in which I've had this privilege of meeting with my teachers. I didn't mention that part because so many of the early members of AA, finding after a while that I really did mean business and I was going to try to expand the concept of community therapy, and to involve the clinical professions at least, they were my early teachers. And my copy of the big book, as many of you know, was a gift from the downtown group in San Francisco, I think in 1953. Now, I don't need to belabor the point that Before 1935, the situation was pretty bad for anybody who had the misfortune to have his life increasingly dominated and determined by dependence, an unhealthy, a sick dependence on alcohol or drugs. The general attitude to such people in the last century was, of course, that they're all sinners. That was pretty well an extension of the classic temperance movement of about 1840. To the extent that my profession took a look at this situation about 1950, at all, they all classified them then as mental cases. So whether it's any better to be a sinner or a mental case. But, and I used to get into some pretty heated arguments with some of my psychiatric friends, particularly in conferences in the United States. I remember one in Boston. This very learned psychoanalyst said, now there's three main classes of psychiatric illness affecting this country. The first are the psychoses, the, you know, schizophrenia, manic depressive, and so on. They lock them up for that. And then there are the neuroses. There's still, people know where they're at, but they're pretty uncomfortable, or they're anxious and depressed and obsessive and so on. But the one that's between and right close to the psychoses are the addictions. And this uncontrolled dependence on alcohol or drugs is really more serious in some ways than the psychoses because they're untreatable. Well, when I attended to tangle with this fellow, you know, I didn't make out so well because he had more people willing to listen to him than to me, but it was a rough deal trying to get across to any audience that all they had to do, if they had an open mind in this situation, to go to a succession of AA meetings, keep an open mind, as they suggest and are trying to do themselves, and try to decide how sick those characters are. Now, some of them are quite ill, and some of them are perfectly normal. And the longer you work in this field, you realize you're dealing with people. If you were dealing with teetotalers, you'd find them all the way from totally insane to normal. If... And... So... And the same thing applies to so-called social drinkers. The big message to get across is that people who happen to have the misfortune to become disabled by controlling dependence upon alcohol and drugs are very similar to those who don't. And that for too long we've been emphasizing the differences rather than the similarity in people who go the one route or the other. Now, so the big, what you really did, you as members of AA, and what your founders did, the most important thing was to absolutely penetrate and break down the universal pessimism concerning the treatability of an unhealthy dependence. Secondly, you help to break down the idea of any stereotype that anybody who happens to have an alcohol problem, you find them flopping around in the gutter someplace. And as far as I'm concerned, it made me think, what if this whole, all of these attitudes about the treatability of an uncontrolled dependence on alcohol or drugs, what if it has no basis in reality at all? What if it is endlessly perpetuated by prejudgment, by prejudice, by pessimism, by defeatism? What if it applies not only with alcohol, but with heroin, with barbiturates, and so on? And this is why I decided to, well, what have I got to lose? You know, at least the field is wide open. There's a lot of competition. And they will have a look. Now, what I want to do now, that's just preliminary, I would like to try to share with you briefly the orientation to this condition that we now use at Donwood. It is the present state of my thinking about this condition after 31 years and close, I think, to 10,000 patients. And I really feel that we finally have an orientation that more satisfactorily explains the interrelated problems of the victim of a controlling dependence on alcohol or drugs than anything we've had before. And this orientation is a stress orientation. And this is what I would like to share with you briefly. Now, a stress and health orientation. And it backs up what I suggested earlier. As far as I'm concerned, one of the important byproducts of such an orientation is to emphasize the similarities rather than the differences between people who happen to have their health affected by an unhealthy dependence on any substance and those who do not. If I use the word health, I'm simply talking about ability to cope. Your state of health, my state of health, is represented by our ability to cope with whatever day-to-day situations we're encountering. Doesn't mean how many push-ups you can do, a lot, that may help a little, you know. It's how are you making out? How are you dealing with your life and your situation, and how much stress do you experience in doing it? Are you lying awake every night, or you sleep like a top? Your reaction to your day-to-day life, one in which you experience disabling states of anxiety, frustration, depression, or not. This is what I mean by health, your overall ability to cope. And by stress, I mean any stimulus or influence from the outside world, physical, chemical, biological, or human, that produces strain on the ability to cope. You and I can have a stressed relationship with just anything, including any chemical in the world, including those that are initially taken because they are capable of producing an acceptable or a desirable change in the way we feel. There is no such thing as a group of chemicals that are safe and another group that are dangerous. any substance in the world can be introduced into the body in what we might call stress doses. We take enough of it. That includes alcohol. And that includes every other chemical you want. It includes oxygen. It includes water. We can be hurt by too much of anything. And once we move up into a danger range, once we move up into a stress dose range of anything, we put the body under strain. Now, using that and relating that stress orientation to some of the physical factors in alcohol addiction, and I like to try to relate it to dependence. Under that, what does intoxication mean? It simply means too much. Intoxication with lead, intoxication with carbon monoxide, intoxication with alcohol, intoxication with morphine. It's possible to be intoxicated by everything, including water. As soon as you get more than your body can handle easily, put it under strain, that's too much. Now, one of the heartening discoveries of the scientists in this field now is to get a little sharper fix on what kind of daily dose of this old substance, alcohol, might be moving into the stress range. I'll tell you, a bottle a day is well over. In fact, a Mickey a day is over. They're beginning to explore the possibility, on the average, mind you, it varies for every person. Every person has his own level, but take the average across. That if somebody develops a pattern of drinking in which they regularly, say, take more than 9 ounces of whiskey a day, or the equivalent in beer, this is certainly enough to begin to be a stress. Now, stress with chemicals, including stress with alcohol, will show up generally in two ways. If you get a sudden overdose of any kind of substance, gas, liquid, or solid, a sudden overdose, acute intoxication, then you know about it, and everybody else knows about it because the changes are obvious. Need more tranquilizers in order to produce any effect. So that from tolerance, the next thing we have to consider is cross-tolerance. And as I'll mention a little later, this can lead to cross-dependence, one of the most serious complicating factors today. Because cross-dependence takes place now amongst many of the victims of an unhealthy dependence upon alcohol to drugs that were never heard of 31 years ago when I went to my first AA meeting. And this certainly complicates the picture for the patient, for the associates, for anybody trying to help them. Tolerance, physical dependence. As it gets up, as a body adapts, say you're adapting now to a slow-down drug. A drug like alcohol, which produces its effect by depressing some of the functions of the nervous system. The response is a speed-up response. So the net result of taking large quantities of alcohol or barbiturates or Valium, whatever, is that the human motor runs faster. And eventually the response of the body begins to be the main thing. And as you pull away the alcohol or the drugs or the Valium, the body's running like a motor without a governor. And this hyperactive state will show up with shakes, hallucinations, convulsions if it's bad enough, and sometimes delirium. This is the physical dependence and withdrawal. Now finally, break and tolerance. Because the body that is attempting to handle a stress dose of a substance like alcohol repeatedly still is trying to cope with all the other stresses. Stresses related to one's social situation. Stresses coming out of one's family relationships. Occupational relationships. Stresses probably from bacteria. And so on and so on. So that there can be a break. And someone reaches the point of a break in tolerance for alcohol. But I want you to remember that it isn't just a break in tolerance for alcohol. It's a break in the capacity to tolerate anything. It's a break in stress tolerance. The capacity to adapt to the day-to-day reality without tension, without anxiety, begins to go down. Now, the stress orientation as far as dependence is concerned. I'd like to share with you what I think the stages in dependence, a workable model at least, for the stages in dependence to alcohol. And first, that is a dependence upon these stressful dose ranges, whether the person recognizes that he's moved into that range or not. First, it's a reactive dependence. It's a reaction to a personal need or a social situation or both. Since 1971, we have been more and more involved with the Department of National Defense, with the U.S. Navy, in helping them to gear up for a more successful program of intervention into the dangerous drinking patterns which are part and parcel of military service. You know, they say that in the workforce in Canada, United States, up to 8 to 10% of the workforce is disabled to some degree by their over-involvement with alcohol. But when you move up into the military circles, it's more like 15%. And when you move into those colonies of people that are suddenly uprooted and put over, say, in Saudi Arabia to help run the oil wells and so on, the social dislocation factor appears to be higher than that again. You move up to the situation of, say, some of the Indian communities, it's more like 50. But what I'm getting at is that in that first stage of dependence, this dependence, repeated dependence on harmful quantities, is a reaction either to a personal need or a social situation or both. And for most people at this stage, I think that this should be regarded as a potentially reversible thing. Now, in the corresponding to the change in tolerance in the physical adaptation, habit is the corresponding change in the psychological area. So we move from a reactive dependence until it becomes an habitual dependence. One builds the technique of drinking into the day-to-day life on a routine basis, and as soon as you do that, what does it mean? It means that drinking in that manner has been adopted as a coping technique. So now the coping technique has been integrated into the lifestyle of that person, but it happens to involve a stress experience itself, whereas it will reduce the awareness of other stresses. What the drinker does not know, what the person with a dependence on drug does not know, that they have a chemical stress as they're built into their lifestyle as a coping mechanism. But there usually is a trouble-free period here, usually, but not always, a trouble-free period in which the person carries on unaware of the fact that he's in any trouble at all. In fact, he thinks he's got it made, you know. And in times of trouble, he's got the bottle, and it depends on whatever the situation is. He can drink in proportion, and he hasn't burned out his tolerance, and no great problem yet. So up to now, he is not in the situation of having had to develop any very elaborate alibi system, or to become very defensive. But sooner or later, sometimes very much, very sooner, almost from the beginning of drinking, and sometimes very much later, the person who is now pretty well being more and more locked into a lifestyle in which drinking in this way is the norm, begins to be aware of problems, begins to be aware that all isn't just exactly as he'd like it to be. And these happen to be, he hates to admit it even to himself, sort of alcohol-related problems, so that he'll move into a stage of defensive dependence. He's on the defensive because the most important technique in adjustment, or one of the most important he has, appears to be threatened. But at this stage, for these people, any threat of consequences is quite unequal to the threat of giving up the technique that is working so well. But he moves into a defensive phase in which there's an alibi system, regardless of whether we're dealing with alcohol, barbiturates, amphetamines, narcotics, whatever. As soon as a person begins to be aware of the fact there are problems related to the use of the substance that I've built into my life. Now, this can go on for varying periods. Probably still coping. Maybe hasn't reached this any point of a break in tolerance. Then, now we come. Let's say we're dealing with a business executive who's pretty well settled into a bottle a day drinking pattern, and he has been able to maintain this, say, for up to 10 years. He's carrying on as little worried about eventual repercussions, really, as the person smoking a packet of cigarettes a day. It just seems to be the same day after day. He is still getting to work every day, and maybe a little fuzzy in the morning, and whatever, but he's there, and that's normal for him, and whatever. But then, a break in his capacity to tolerate alcohol, and a break in his capacity to not only his alcohol tolerance, but his stress tolerance. From now on, he'll be under strain from less and less. He'll be under strain from work situations that didn't formerly cause strain or trouble. Home situations. He'd be more anxious, more irritable, and so on. So the break in tolerance for alcohol, I'm more and more convinced, is but one manifestation of a general break in the capacity to cope at all. Now, recalling that drinking is the coping mechanism, what do you find? You find that the dependence goes up, the tolerance goes down, and as one drinker dramatically expressed it to me, he said, then you're on a roller coaster to hell. But the whole point is, it's a disastrous situation. The whole problem begins to disintegrate rapidly. So we move then from a defensive dependence to a helpless dependence. And this helpless dependence is going to end, but the person's life begins to be almost totally determined by his need, in a surrender experience. And this surrender experience can take, I think, one of mainly three forms. Up to now, the person has been trying to retain some kind of control over his family problems, relationships, and responsibility, his work and his community. And this is in competition with the power, the increasing invasion into his life of the activities related to drinking or drugs. So one form of surrender is to give up any pretense of trying to hold on to any community status, family status, or whatever. They just let their dependents shove them around, the police shove them around. You'll find a lot of these people rotating around on through the courts and whatever. Another surrender form is in suicide. When people get totally trapped to the point that life without alcohol or drugs has become impossible, and life with it has become intolerable, and they see no way out, then there's no great mystery about the fact that suicides at this point are higher than in the population as a whole. And of course, the third one is to take the step in thinking somehow that was the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, stress orientation to recovery. We feel, first of all, that the vast majority, not the minority, the vast majority of those who have become over-involved with alcohol or drugs to the point of helplessness can, with proper help over a long enough time, achieve recovery from dependence, optimal repair of the related problems, and move up the scale in a general ability to cope, in general health. And these are the objectives of therapy that we have developed at Dawnwood. And again, we expect that if we can help a patient to interrupt the dependence upon alcohol, they'll go through a period of reducing dependence, Just because a person stops drinking doesn't mean that the psychological dependence is inactive at that point. There's a lively awareness of something missing for quite a while. Eventually moving into the final stage of dependence when it's inactive. The related problems. The package of physical, psychological, and social problems presented by these patients is just so diverse as to, there's no one way to describe it. Why should the clinical professions be involved at the start? Because so many of these problems, the related problems, problems related to the dependence, both those that help to initiate and sustain it, and the other problems arising out of it, these problems can be so varied, so complex, that they can challenge the total clinical resources of the community. And if we're thinking in terms of putting people on an escalator to a new and healthier lifestyle instead of just getting involved in a revolving door, then it is important that those people in the community who have been trained to recognize this range of associated problems do so and have an opportunity to point out these particular things are indicated for this particular person. This doesn't interfere at all with the overall community model. It doesn't interfere at all with the idea of patients helping patients. It doesn't interfere at all with them becoming involved in AA. But it does mean that we now have removed enough of the stigma and brought up enough interest so that if a patient could benefit from some of the input from the clinical professions, it's there for them. And hopefully soon will be as readily available as if he were disabled by an infection, a broken leg, or anything else. Not only is there a fantastic range of disabilities, physical disabilities related to the gastrointestinal system, the liver, the stomach, the pancreas, the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, the heart, and so on, but an unhealthy dependence on alcohol or drugs can mask a whole range of other things, from cancer, tuberculosis, you name it. So to begin with, ideally, there should be a comprehensive assessment of the physical, psychological, and social status of each patient. And not only looking for the clinically significant problem, but the resources, the personal and social resources to cope with them. And when we talk about a two-year period, not only is it a period to interrupt and inactivate a dependence upon chemicals, of course, it is to initiate and improve the ability to depend upon people. If we find patients who have serious psychological barriers to communication, they have a great deal of difficulty in relating warmly to other people, probably as a result, an aftermath of some childhood experience. We want, if possible or if necessary, to take advantage of all of, or any or all, of the new psychological techniques, particularly group techniques, to break through these barriers to communication and open the door to a new lifestyle in which in times of need it's easier for them to turn to a person instead of a chemical. So the input of the paraprofessionals, psychologists and so on, can be very significant. And this is what we want. We want the physiotherapist to demonstrate that there are very many techniques in relaxation that a person can learn one or more of these techniques. And in times of need, in coping with the day-to-day stresses, instead of turning to the chemical world, turn to one's own unused resources or turn to some other people with special skills. And we do feel that it is possible, certainly within a two-year period, to achieve a very significant improvement in health in all the three main significant areas, physical, psychological, and social. Now, finally, the clinical adaptation of community therapy. We are still working on plans whereby the whole job does not have to be done just by the peers, just by others who have had a similar problem. We've tried to demonstrate how you can integrate the resources of the clinical profession and of the community generally and add them to the input of patients themselves. Most of you probably know that AA, from the beginning of Donwood, meets twice a week at Donwood, and this, we wanted all patients to have an opportunity to see this and become identified with it, and to be able to become identified with it when they went back home as an adjunct to anything we might do insofar as assisting them in the inactivation of dependence and repair of the related problems. But we do feel that we have done something in changing the attitudes of the rest of the community, and that we can look forward to still improved formula for the interaction of all segments of the community, the employers, the physicians, and so on. Now, in spite of the fact that largely through your pioneering efforts, by the demonstration that you provide for the clinical professions, in spite of the fact that we now know that we can come up with pretty consistently helpful formulae for treatment of most of the victims of chemical dependence, in spite of this, the rate at which unhealthy drinking patterns are being assumed around the world is accelerating all the time. So in spite of the gain in the field of treatment, we have to this point totally failed not only to prevent, we can't even arrest an acceleration. The number of people who are involved, over-involved with alcohol and drugs is on the increase. Now again, here's what I think might be possible. For example now, if there's one word I think most consistently might describe part of the situation of the person dependent on alcohol or drugs, it's loneliness. And one of the great advantages of a supplementary community like Alcoholics Anonymous is to provide a framework for the alleviation of loneliness. Now, let's look at some of the other factors contributing to loneliness now. It's been estimated that up to about one-third of the total workforce are shifted all over the place. They don't stay in one place. So that in responding to the demands of modern business and industry and technology, people are shuffled around the country. There's continually less opportunity to develop rewarding relationships with family, work associates, or in the community. And in direct proportion to disturbing the established social situations, the social institutions which provided the opportunity for effective interaction, the breakdown in the effectiveness of the family, community, and so on, we find the shift in the other direction from people to chemicals. And I think that there is probably an infinite range of methods where we could explore the possibility of supplementary communities, bringing people together again with common objectives, common purpose, in a manner that they can find in their interrelationships an opportunity for fulfillment that's being denied them at the present time. And I think that probably in this direction we might think of some really significant advances in early recognition and prevention. So that I just want to end by telling you something that my wife said long ago. She traveled around with me, went to many AA meetings. She said she doesn't happen to have any serious over-involvement with alcohol, but she said, if anything ever happened to you and I was lonely, I would promptly go to AA, because there is no other organization I know of in the world where I could go from city to city and walk in and be welcomed, and as there is with this organization. And she said, if I had to, I've been close enough to you, if I had to make up a story, I could. So, they... But the point is, she recognized something very significant about the fundamental dynamics of your community. And I personally am convinced that not only a supplementary community relationship, not only has it application, usefulness, for those who have been disabled by an unhealthy dependence on alcohol or drugs, I wouldn't be the slightest surprised if it proves to be the avenue for further research and development to prevent a whole range of problems associated with the rapid disintegration of the traditional social institutions. It's been a real privilege to have this opportunity to talk to you.